Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, and alongside me is my co-host, Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. We're back at the Playboy Mansion, which means looking at a lot of young women look awkward, pretend to be impressed by Hugh Hefner, and, you know, mostly mediocre fights. I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but I don't understand the point of Playboy Mansion cards. There's nothing special. Felt like a promotional thing for Playboy. I don't know what Strikeforce got out of it. I know we'll be talking about the salaries later, but not too much there in terms of extra dollars to pay the fighters. So I don't know. It's going to be a fun one. It's interesting. And there's a lot of good, a lot of bad about this show. So I'm looking forward to talking to you about it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. A lot of good, a lot of bad. Definitely some mismatches, some decisive finishes for sure that result from those mismatches, and, you know, very questionable stoppage that will probably be the big thing that we really disagree on and go into detail about. But we're going to get to all that. For our listeners that are new, Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 to 2013. The episode we're talking about, as you might have guessed, we're talking about Strikeforce at the Mansion 2. This was the second and final, thankfully, Playboy Mansion card for Strikeforce. I don't even know if there was ever any other MMA events held there, but it featured a quick return for Josh the Pump Thompson, who had just beaten Gilbert Melendez for the Strikeforce lightweight title in an absolute barn burner of a fight. Several other Strikeforce fighters would return, including Joe Diesel Riggs, Corey DeVella, and Luke Stewart. We would also see the promotional debuts of Pride veterans Kazuo Misaki and Mitsuhiro Ishida. So it's definitely some notable names on here. Want to mention fallout from the previous event, Melendez versus Thompson. We saw the Strikeforce debut of Misha Tate, who would, of course, go on to be a big, big star for the promotion, help put women's MMA on the map. In addition, Billy Evangelista got his fourth Strikeforce win, really setting himself up as a potential challenger for the new lightweight champion, Josh Thompson. And finally, Bobby Southworth had gotten revenge against Anthony Ruiz and beat him in a rematch that had the title on the line this time. All right, so let's dive into it. I want to get into the fight announcements and that sort of thing, but there's a little tidbit from the Wrestling Observer that you wanted to mention here, Josh.
Yeah, I just wanted to know that actually the Wrestling Observer did not cover the show or any of their affiliate newsletters, looked up and down, but they did have a little bit of a mention about how there was some work behind the scenes to get this show to get broadcast live, that they were trying to hook up a television deal to show it. And don't talk about what network. It says it fell through at the last minute, and that was a disappointment to the Strikeforce executives behind the scenes. So they ended up streaming it live on SureDog.com. And the show did air in Canada on The Score, so they did have some TV. And also, we haven't talked about this much, but around this time, Phil, Strikeforce, I don't know if you remember, but they did have a show at least 2 a.m. in California on NBC, and it was sort of like the best of Strikeforce and highlights, and their most recent show before this did about 432,000 viewers. So as we talk about Strikeforce and its effort to be number two in MMA, also the big part of that is distribution and platform and all of the different ways that they're trying to get on national television. And this was one of the shows where they were trying, but I guess it didn't work out.
Yeah, and I'll mention in our we had a bonus episode with MMA journalist John S. Nash, and we actually go into the NBC deal a little bit. It sounds great on the outside, but like you said, it was at like 2 a.m. on Saturdays, so not really a viable time slot. And there were a lot of, you know, UFC was looking at broadcasts at this point, Elite XC, that sort of thing. But it's a good segue to talk about the Score deal. It was announced around this time that Strikeforce had come to an agreement with the Score, which was a Canadian sports TV network, which they were similar to the NBC deal. They were going to produce a weekly show of, you know, highlights and that sort of thing, and it extended Strikeforce's reach, and the Score was a big deal up in the Great White North. So nice win for both sides. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's get into the card itself. And in early August, it was announced that Strikeforce would return to the Playboy Mansion on September 20th. It was revealed that recent signee Hinato Babalu Sobral would challenge Bobby Southworth for the Strikeforce light heavyweight title. And this would have been a big, big fight, but it would end up being postponed. It would eventually happen, and we'll talk about that soon. But both fighters got injured and got replaced on this card, so it ended up being a non-title scrap between Trevor Prangley and Anthony Ruiz. Prangley Ruiz was actually a rematch of a very controversial Strikeforce fight that took place at Tank versus Buentello back in 2006. In that fight, Prangley had caught Ruiz in an armbar, and the ref just jumped in and stopped it. Ruiz didn't tap and was very upset, and the crowd booed Prangley. It was kind of ugly. I wasn't a fan of it because Prangley didn't do anything wrong, and Prangley did have it in really deep. I mean, he had that armbar on very tight, so I think that would have been it. But you know, at the same time, Ruiz didn't tap, and you never know. So
was it Josh Rosenthal? Was that the ref?
I don't know. No, I don't think it was Rosenthal. We would see Rosenthal later on in this card in a very controversial moment. So a little foreshadowing there. But in a featured fight, the aforementioned Misaki would take on Joe Diesel Riggs. This would actually end up being the main event. Also, Josh Thompson would appear in a non-title bout with Lion's Den fighter Ash Bowman. For those that may not remember, Lion's Den that was Ken Shamrock's team for a long time. And then Mitsuhiro Ishida, a name familiar to Pride fans, would take on AKA standout Justin Wilcox. And then lastly, Corey the One Develo would be matched up with Terry Martin. And I wanted to mention, as I was doing my research, I knew Martin from the flying knee knockout. I think it might have been UFC like 54 or something like that, but it was a flying knee knockout from James the Sandman Ervin at the very beginning of the second round, where Ervin just kind of walks, you know, they do that walk towards the middle of the cage, pretty much everyone besides Diego Sanchez, who's a maniac and runs. But they kind of were doing that walk, and Ervin just kind of used that walk to build up and unleash this nasty flying knee that put Martin out cold. So I remember him from that, but he's got a really fascinating backstory. I found an MMA Weekly article where it mentioned that Martin was a former gang member who had survived 5 gunshot wounds that nearly took his life at age 15 on the streets of Chicago, where he was born. However, he had turned his life around, become the first member of his family to get his high school diploma, and then earned a bachelor's degree from Northern Illinois University, and was actually, at the time of this card, was pursuing a master's degree in psychology, which is pretty amazing. And I think I went back and tried to look, and I believe that he completed that. I mean, he's extremely well-educated and all that. So really fascinating story. And no matter what he did in his MMA career, I mean, he did have some success, just an amazing, incredible story. So, but yeah. Let's jump into what was going on in the UFC at this time. No changes since the last Strikeforce event. BJ Penn still the lightweight champion, GSP still the undisputed welterweight champion after stopping Matt Serra at UFC 83, and he would start a reign that would last until 2012. Anderson Silva, still the middleweight champ. Forrest Griffin, now the UFC light heavyweight champion after beating Rampage Jackson. And then the heavyweight scene was still pretty muddled in the UFC. Minotauro Nogueira was technically the interim heavyweight champion, but Randy Couture was still officially the UFC heavyweight champion, and he would be back to defend that title before the end of the year. The closest UFC event that took place was UFC 88, took place a couple weeks before this second Playboy Mansion show. It featured several very big fights. Dong Hyung Kim beat Matt Brown, who's still with the UFC, which is pretty amazing, via split decisions. Future Strikeforce champ Nate Marquardt TKO'd Martin Kampmann with punches, and future Fedor killer Dan Henderson decisioned one of the dirtiest fighters in MMA history, Husamar Palharis. Let's stop right there just for a quick second. Josh, I put this out on Twitter, and for every, I want to mention, we have changed our Twitter handle and our Instagram handle so that way they can be one and the same. So it's now at the Hexagon Pod. So all you have to do on social media platforms is search for at the Hexagon Pod and you will find us. That way there's no discrepancies there. But I tweeted out asking who are the dirtiest fighters in MMA history. And I'll, Josh, I won't put you on the spot other than to say, I'm going to give you the kind of the ones that came to mind first for me and a few others that I've seen mentioned. But I want to see if you agree, if there's anybody that you feel different. But Palharis, absolutely. I mean, the guy doesn't know how to let go of a very, very dangerous move in the heel hook. So he's definitely up there. Gilbert Ivel, the Hurricane. I don't know if you remember him, but I mean, he knocked out a ref at one point. sticking his fingers in Don the Predator Fry's eyes in Pride is one of the most egregious cheating things I've ever seen. He's done some other stuff. To me, they're kind of one and two. And I'm not talking about guys that were doping or anything like that. I'm talking about guys that did stuff that was dirty in the cage. You know, John Jones gets a lot of flack for fingers to the eyes. And then also that kind of down kick to the knee that some people want to see outlawed in MMA, but he's another one that comes to mind. There's a guy named Dirty Bob Schreiber in the kind of the early days of Pride that was known for really, he did this, I remember he did an axe kick that was to the head of a downed opponent that was pretty nasty. So I remember him as well. But anybody else come to mind as far as, you know, dirty fighters goes?
Well, I mean, this might be given a bad rap, but, you know, Paul Daly, I think, you know, had a bad reputation, you know, taking the late swing against Josh Koscheck. And there's certainly other fights he was in where nothing that flagrant, but he was definitely sort of into it after the bell or, you know, inappropriate spots. I think Paul Harris is the worst of the worst because you can literally break somebody's bones the way he would hold on to that heel lock, and he would not let go, and then he would just do it over and over, and he would, you know, act like, you know, he didn't hear the ref or whatever. So he's probably the most flagrant that I can think of.
Yeah, and there's a I kind of did a little bit of a deep dive on him, and Jake Shields, his fight with Jake Shields in the World Series of Fighting was pretty flagrant, and he made Shields really angry, and Shields like punched him after the bell and got in trouble for it. And then Joe Lozon, I believe, did a YouTube breakdown of Paul Harris holding on to the holds and how long you should hold on to them after the tap and that sort of thing. And he always acted like, what? But you have to be a professional and know, you know, you have to be fully aware and conscious of what you're doing. And he just, it didn't seem to be like on purpose. It just, but, you know, regardless, you can't do that, especially with leg locks. So, yeah.
Paul Harris is lucky he never fought Mike Tyson. Mike Tyson bit off Evander Holyfield's ear, one, because he was losing the fight, but also he complained about the incessant headbutting that Evander was doing when they were close, and nobody called him on it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that would have been pretty nasty. All right, but back to UFC 88. In the co-main event, Rich Franklin got a TKO win over Matt Hamill via body kick. And then in the main event, Rashad Evans knocked out former champ Chuck Liddell with a sick overhand right. Do you remember this, Josh? Do you remember that overhand, like kind of almost baseball, like throw knockout?
Oh yeah. Highlight reel. Time for Chuck Liddell to go. Yeah.
Yeah. You know. That was it. And this would be the slide that would end the career of the Iceman. After this loss to Evans, he would get stopped by Shogun Hua and Rich Franklin with punches in consecutive fights before he retired. And then unfortunately came back in 2018 and lost to Tito Ortiz in that one-off MMA fight for Golden Boy for De La Hoya's Golden Boy Promotions. And, you know, obviously wish he hadn't come back for that, but yeah, this would be, this would actually be the first of that career ending side for the Iceman. So,
hey, you know, you mentioned Jake Shields, and then you also just mentioned Martin Kampmann here. Do you remember Jake Shields versus Kampmann? It might've been his UFC debut. Do you remember that fight?
No, I don't.
And it was one of those fights where Jake probably lost, but he ended up winning the split decision. And it was very controversial. But if you ever see that fight, I'm pretty sure it was Jake's debut. And he came in hot as this, like, jiu-jitsu master. And they're going to match him up against GSP, which they eventually did. But I recall that Kampmann fight. Kampmann probably beat him. And Jake got very, very lucky with the cards, with the decision. So I don't know, something for you to take a look at when you have, some free time.
You are correct. That was his UFC debut. It was October 23rd, 2010 at UFC 121, Lesnar versus Velasquez.
Yeah.
Prior to that, Dana White say that Shields was most likely next for a shot at the welterweight title. If he beat Kampmann, and after he beat him via split decision, that's when White later confirmed that Shields would receive a title shot against the winner of George St. Pierre versus Josh Koscheck, which was taking place at UFC 124. So there you go.
You should watch that. I think it's one of the ones where they're like, oh man, we're going to make a lot more money with GSP and Shields than GSP and anyone else. So
yeah,
you got to win this fight.
Yeah. You might question whether Dana got in somebody's ear or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to get back to this closest challengers event. There was a Strikeforce challengers event on September 13th, which was a couple weeks before. This was Young Guns 3. No big name fighters on this card at all. A couple familiar names though. Alexander Trevina, who had beaten Eric Jacob, who's the guy that had gone 1-9 in the year 2008. We discussed on our last event episode. He would get a decision over Gennaro Strangis, while George Interior Noez, the Tong Po lookalike that we talked about recently on the Melendez versus Thompson episode would get submitted via armbar by Chris Bostic in the first round. All right, we've now arrived at the Strikeforce at the Mansion 2 event itself. It took place on September 20th, 2008 at the Playboy Mansion in Beverly Hills, California. According to Wikipedia, which we all know is 100% accurate at all times.
And you know, just a $5 donation will really make a difference long term.
Yeah. Hey, I've done that. I think I do that once a year.
Because I use
Wikipedia a lot. So I'm
well, I mean, like, it gets a bad rap, but I mean, most of the stuff is accurate. Come on.
Well, I think it's pretty easy to check. Look, if there's a citation, and if there's no citation, then take it with a massive grain of salt. If there is a citation, make sure especially if you're going to use this for anything or repeat it to somebody, make sure you check the article and make sure it's reputable. So I think it's pretty easy to check it. I think it's great. I love, man, every time I watch a movie, either during or afterwards, I open up IMDb and I always look at the trivia for that movie. I always look at the rating, look at the trivia, whatever. And then I always go over to Wikipedia and see if there's anything to add to it. And that's one of my favorite things to do. And I'll just annoy my wife during the show and say, oh, hey, did you know that this guy was also in? And, you know, I'll just do that the entire I'll do that either before we go to sleep or whatever. But yeah, I think Wikipedia is great. So I try to at least give my $5 once a year. But anyways, Wikipedia said that the attendance for this was 2,478, which I do not buy. Based on watching the event itself, I didn't see that. I also don't know how they'd get almost 2,500 people in there, but you know, I could be wrong. Wikipedia also added, and this did not have a citation, so I don't know if it's true, but they did have this at the first event, so I think that it is. It said all guests were entitled to a top shelf open bar, buffet style gourmet dinner and wine tasting party featuring the spirits of various California gold medal wineries. I mean, they had that at the first event that was confirmed by Gorgeous George Garcia of MMA Junkie. You can check in the archives to hear our interview with him. So I assume that they did the same thing. And I will also mention that I just recently started listening to another true crime podcast series that talks about this Playboy playmate from the late 70s that was, she died, she was murdered at age 20. And it's walking you through how she became a playmate and all that sort of thing. You know, obviously it's more focused on the crime side of it. And she had this like psycho boyfriend and all that stuff, but you can hear what the Playboy Mansion was like in the late 70s and kind of, you know, in its heyday, although this was a little bit past its prime, but it was still a big deal and all the stuff they were doing. And you could see, you know, you could see why to an extent that Strikeforce would go here or any MMA promotion would go here. I mean, obviously you have a very male dominated sport, although I think it's a little less so now. And you know, obviously men like beautiful women for the most part. So, you know, it kind of seems to go hand in hand, but
for the record, Phil, I like intelligent women first. That's okay, the number
good, one. Good. Good. I'm sure your wife listens to this show every single time. So, go ahead. You found this YouTube video that you want to mention?
I wanted to just note that 2,400 number is interesting. But the biggest problem with these shows is I saw this YouTube video, I looked it up. It's set up like a wedding. I mean, there's like round tables and people have to sort of face the back of their table to watch the show. Most people are mingling. They're not really into the fights. It's just not an MMA crowd. And I'm so glad they never went back to do this kind of thing, because I just don't know what the payoff is, other than you're telling, I guess, the person who's going to watch the show that you might see some scantily clad women also, but there is no TV deal in the US, so I don't really know how that matters. So I mean, both of MMA fighting is great, and obviously the Playboy brand is successful. I just don't, at least with these two shows, see how they meshed.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really get it either. And I don't think it was a good look either. So you're not going to get an argument from me on that. But what you might get an argument from me on is the commentary of Ken Shamrock. The world's most dangerous man, Ken Shamrock, made his Strikeforce commentary debut at this event. He provided color as World Series of Poker veteran Lon McCarron handled play-by-play. And we had Jimmy Lennon Jr. back as the ring announcer. So with that, let's jump into the fights themselves. Undercard at a catchweight bout, 195 pounds. Jesse Gillespie defeated Dave Martin via split decision. Gillespie and Martin had fought once before, with Gillespie winning by decision. And you know, it was an okay one. It was obviously two guys that were very early in their career, but I do want to mention a little interesting note. Gillespie would fight only one more time while Martin was one and done, or I'm sorry, was done with this one, finishing 0-2 in his career with both losses coming to Gillespie. That's gotta be pretty rough. Either that guy, if I'm Martin, either Gillespie becomes my best friend and we just, you know, laugh about this kind of stuff. And secretly, I hold this hatred in my heart for him the entire time for, you know, beating me in my only two MMA fights. Or I just want to never hear his name again. One of the two. So, moving on, Brandon Magana defeated Brandon Thatch via split decision. Both fighters would not be back in Strikeforce. This was a welterweight bout. In fact, Magana only fought one more time in his career. Thatch's name might ring a bell. He fought multiple times in the UFC going 2-4. Then at 185 pounds, Eric Lawson defeated Kenneth Segrist via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 307 of the first round. Lawson was a very strong wrestler, 6-2, coming off a win over Jesse Gillespie at Melendez versus Thompson, who he'd seen in the opening bout on this card. Segrist was undefeated at 3-0. And I got to say, as I watch this, Kenneth Segrist looked like a serial killer standing in the corner before the fight. I mean, he was just staring down Eric Lawson prior to the bell, and he had this kind of like skullet kind of thing going on with like a little like kind of rat tail thing at the back, and he would stare at Lawson, and then he would slowly close his eyes and kind of breathe in, and then he'd stare at Lawson again. I mean, he looked like he wanted to murder him.
I saw that. I totally agree with you. The look was so intense, though, it almost to me felt like he was also trying to convince himself.
trying to make up for fear or something.
Yeah, that he was about to fight. It was simultaneously the greatest combination of like courage and fear at the same time. The look in his eyes. It was almost like he was like, "Damn, I got to fight, and I'm going to try to scare this guy because hopefully it'll make my fighting easy." But yeah, you definitely don't want to ever see that look on the opposite face of somebody coming after you.
Yeah, I was not thinking like, oh, this is a guy that I don't know. I was kind of torn. I was like, either this guy's going to murder him or this guy is going to just get blown out of the water. Cause it just seemed like he was trying so hard to look scary, you know? So, but for the fight itself, the two touch gloves, and Seagrass thinking he was really slick, tried to throw a quick right. I don't know did you notice that as well? Like they do the glove touch. And Seagrass, very unsportsmanlike, immediately tries to throw a right hand. And Lawson, whether he either saw it coming or not, he ducked right under, picked him up, and turned around and deposited Seagrass on his back in front of the corner. Did you think that was kind of dirty?
I didn't pick up on it that way. And I saw that. But by the time he picked him up and threw him, I mean, I was just focused on that. I kind of overlooked the stuff before. But yeah, it would make sense that he's trying to do whatever he can, from giving evil death stares to basically, you know, trying to take a shortcut.
Yeah, it definitely looked like a shortcut to me. But to his credit, Seagrass got a tight guillotine on Lawson, who defended it well. But that was really the story of the fight. Lawson getting all these takedowns anytime he wanted one. He got one, and Seagrass would grab a guillotine every time because Lawson would leave his neck out there. And I think if he'd been up against someone more experienced than Seagrass, I think Lawson would have been in a lot more trouble. And even without that, Seagrass got the choke on pretty tight a couple of times. But in the end, Lawson was the one who got the submission win, and he got Seagrass back, flattened him out, and with blood flowing out of his nose, Seagrass was forced to tap to the rear naked choke.
Yeah, I mean, they say looks kill, but they certainly don't know how to fight. And a good game plan always beats an intense stare. I mean, this guy got just mopped. And the look was gone, by the way. But by the time he was, actually engaging and he was being squeezed and Lawson was holding him, I mean, that look was gone. So this was good. You know, it's not really super exciting to see this kind of a fight in terms of those who want a knockout and a big stand up, but Lawson was just totally on him. He didn't let go. Too much pressure, and Seagrass just eventually he could not survive 5 minutes like that. He came out too stiff. He didn't really look loose at all. It's like, dude, take a chill pill. You got to relax if you're going to be in there. Breathe. And he paid for it. He just psyched himself out, I think.
Yeah, I think he got in his own head too much. But Lawson would be back in Strikeforce multiple times. Seagrass would not. However, he seems to actually still be active. He last fought in 2019, currently holds an 8-7 record. So not a busy fighter, but continues to kind of dabble in the sport, it seems like.
He's probably in it for the money, right? Yeah,
probably not fighting at his level. All right, in a welterweight bout, Luke Stewart defeated Jesse Juarez via submission, coming by way of armbar at 455 the first round. Stewart was 5-1, coming off a loss to UFC veteran Tiki Gosen by decision at Shamrock versus Lee. He's looking to bounce back and get back on track. Juarez was 6-4. This was a very classic striker versus grappler battle, and as usual, grappling won out. Stewart got Juarez to the ground several times, and right before the end of the first round, he locked in an armbar where Juarez was so tied up that he could barely tap. So it was a very nice win for Stewart, nice way for him to get back in the win column.
This was a good match. Stewart looked really good. He worked hard. He showed a little bit of shades of Jake Shields to me. Just kind of that lanky, sticking like glue to his opponent, not letting his opponent really get any oxygen. So I thought he did pretty well. The only thing I'd say about Stewart, and I've said this before, is that he just doesn't look like he wants to be a fighter when he's in there. I mean, he's very focused. He's doing the work, but, you know, he's not Josh Thompson. This is not a guy who's in there who's having fun and smiling. And that can make for a little bit of it takes away a little bit of the enthusiasm for the viewer. And again, you know, for those of you who are listening and like wondering, well, this is a fight. We're talking about the growth and development of Strikeforce, and all of these things really matter. All the presentation matters, and we're sort of looking at which fighters stood out, which ones were just kind of solid, and which ones maybe didn't have the personality that would have helped them become bigger stars. So, you know, in that context, I think Stewart was certainly way better than his personality would display every time he stepped in the cage.
Yeah, and maybe it has to do with this is a nice little segue, but this was actually the last win of Stewart's career. He would fight two more times in Strikeforce and lose both of them. So we'll discuss him a bit more, but maybe his passion for the sport was starting to wane at this point. And he was starting to realize that this was, you know, he'd rather be a tattoo artist and really focus on that versus fighting. So maybe that was what was coming through. But Juarez would not compete in Strikeforce again, but he would fight a bunch of times in Bellator, and he does have a pretty big win on his record. He holds a win over current UFC middleweight contender Robert Whittaker. So nice feather in your cap for anybody in the middleweight division. All right, we have arrived at the main card, and opening things up, we have a 205-pound light heavyweight matchup between Trevor Prangley and Anthony Ruiz that saw Prangley get his hand raised at the end after a unanimous decision victory. As mentioned earlier, this was a rematch for the two of them. Prangley, who was 17-5 coming in, was coming off a loss 10 months earlier to George Santiago during the final round of the Strikeforce Four Men Enter One Man Survives one-night middleweight tournament. Now he was back, looking to do right things with inside the hexagon. Ruiz was 21-11. He'd come back from his decision loss to Bobby Southworth to get a decision win over Jeremy Freitag in Elite XC. And apologies to Jeremy if I mispronounced his last name there. But the winner of this fight would probably be in line after Bob Alou to challenge for the Strikeforce Light Heavyweight Championship. So there were some stakes to this match. Hugh Hefner, shown at cage side, and man, even back in 2008, he was looking pretty old, pretty haggard to me.
Was he Vince McMahon old or
older? No, he was not Vince McMahon old. Definitely older than Vince McMahon. But, you know, like the whole silk pajamas thing and pipe and all that stuff probably looks cool, like, you know, or probably look cool for him when he was in his 40s and 50s. You know what I'm saying? But now it just looks like he's ready for bed. Like, that's all that really tells me at that point. And when I say ready for bed, I mean ready to go to sleep. You know what I'm saying? Like, just looking very old there.
It might have been this shot, but one of the shots, there was somebody who was – they were showing him, handing him like notes.
Came over and showed him some papers or something like that. Like,
I couldn't imagine Hugh Hefner knew of anyone inside that cage at all.
Oh, highly doubt it. He probably knew who Ken Shamrock was, or may have known who Ken Shamrock was, but I highly doubt there was really anybody else that he knew there.
And if you're Hugh Hefner, do you want to take your girlfriend's cage side to watch all these professional athletes?
Yeah, much younger, good look, you know, seeing a good looking guy like Josh Thompson in there, and you're like, I'm smart. I have more money than him. You know, maybe you just remind him that. But anyways, but you could tell, and I'm interested to hear what you thought about the commentary, but you could tell almost right away that McCarron, the play-by-play guy, knew some but not much about MMA, called some of the wrong moves at times, but then he would surprise me sometimes and get something right that was a little more intricate than what maybe the average, you know, fan might know. So I thought he was okay, but I definitely not, you know, nowhere near somebody like Morrow or even, you know, Kenny Rice or one of those guys. So
oh yeah, nothing at all, and nothing will ever compare to Gus Johnson calling Seth Petruccelli's knockout of Kimbo Slice on CBS the biggest upset in the history of mixed martial arts.
Yeah.
So nothing is that bad. Yeah. I did like Shamrock. I thought he did well. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, we'll talk more about them. Yeah. But early cup shot from Prangley stopped the action for a bit. Ruiz had more power in his strikes, but it was a little wild. Did touch Prangley a couple times, but the big South African was able to withstand, eventually getting a nice throat takedown. And he worked a choke, even getting Ruiz's back, but the American reversed and landed some from the top. Good first round. I'd call it 10-9 for Prangley. Great takedown by Prangley to start off the second, and that was really the story there. It was complete domination for the AKA fighter, 10-9, if not 10-8 for Prangley, and that continued on into the third. More takedowns by Prangley, who cut Ruiz near the eye. In the end, Ruiz was just never able to really get anything going, and this time there was no doubt as to who the winner was.
Yeah, Prangley fought a good fight. You know, he's a smart fighter. Ken Shamrock had pointed out in here that, you know, he's very muscular. He's very fit. He's got a lot of endurance, and he did a good job. He had a game plan. Ruiz just could not stop that takedown. And, I mean, I wouldn't call it, like, the most exciting fight I've ever seen, but it was a good display of skill. And Prangley did what he did best, which was, you know, wrestle and wear people down. And I thought Ken Shamrock did well on this one in particular because he was seeming to know what was happening, you know, second before it would happen, much less flamboyant than Frank Shamrock. Shamrock has Ken Shamrock has a little bit of a down to earth quality about him. Mm-hmm. Whereas Frank is definitely more of a performance commentator. So
yeah. That's a good point. I agree. I think Ken actually breaks it down a little more, you know, he needs to move his hips that way or that sort of thing versus Ken, like you said, a little bit more kind of selling while he's talking. So
yeah, Frank's always working and Ken, oddly, he's the pro wrestler in this context. He seems like exactly the kind of guy you want to be sitting next to at the bar talking to you about the fight. Like he knew what he was talking about.
Yeah. And all you have to do is look at his face or his arms and know that he knows what he's talking about. So, I thought he did a good job too. But both fighters will be back in Strikeforce in the future, but neither would end up getting a title shot. And I will mention here now, actually, as we record this, I talked to Trevor Prangley on the phone earlier today, and we are scheduled to do an interview. Which will end up, as long as it happens, will end up being our fighter interview that we will run, and we're going to talk about this fight during that interview. So looking forward to connecting with Trevor and getting his insight on this fight, as well as talking a little bit about the rest of his Strikeforce fights. So looking forward to that. In the next fight, 155-pound fight between Mitsuhiro Ishida and Justin Wilcox. Ishida defeats Wilcox via submission, coming by way of armbar at 121 of the first round. Ishida was a top Japanese fighter. He held a record of 16-4-1 coming into this. He had handed Gilbert Melendez his first ever loss 10 months before this event in the Land of the Rising Sun. He'd also had a strong run in Pride, going 4-1 with his only loss coming to one of my favorite, probably my favorite Japanese fighter, Takanori Gomi. This was his U.S. mainland debut. He had fought in Hawaii previously, but this would be the first time we would see him within the confines of the Continental States.
You know who my favorite Japanese fighter is, Phil?
Who's that?
Shinsuke Nakamura. And before you say something, he is a fighter. So there you go.
He was a fighter. Yes. I got nothing bad to say about Shinsuke. If anybody that can get in there and beat Bob Sapp, I'm a fan of. So no issue there. And if you don't know what we're talking about, go back to the Strikeforce at the Dome show that we covered and kind of went into all that. So, but Wilcox, he would also be making his Strikeforce debut. He's 5-2, coming off a win over Gabe Rudiger, very solid fighter. So very strong member, and another member of AKA, another one of these kind of blonde, like really, really strong wrestlers that AKA just seem to attract like flies to honey. So, Yeah. But funny thing here, Josh, did you notice this? During the In-Cage announcements, Jimmy Lennon Jr. announced that Justin Wilcox was a member of the Ultimate Fighter Season 5. And Wilcox made this face like, what? And like, and I had to look it up. I was like, I don't remember him being on the Ultimate Fighter. And I watched Season 5 was one of the – I watched 1, 3, and 5 for sure. So I don't remember him. He was definitely not on any seasons of Tough. So – I even looked up the season 5 cast to see who he could have been mistaken for. And I mean, there was nobody named Justin, maybe Gray Maynard, cause I think he had like short kind of a crew cut, similar, I guess. And they're in the same weight class, but yeah, that was really funny to see Wilcox, like look at Lennon, like what? That guy cracked me up.
That's up there with Pat Patterson winning the Intercontinental title in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in terms of mythology. I was disappointed by that because, yes, you could see Wilcox's look like, do I need to go punch Jimmy Lennon right now? What is he talking about?
Am I taking on two guys here?
It's crazy, though. Obviously, somebody did some bad research for Jimmy Lennon Jr., and he just was reading off the card, which is even more disappointing because, damn, he's such a good ring announcer. And you're thinking, does this guy know anything he's saying on any of these words?
Yeah, it makes you question everything else, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. But you mentioned Pat Patterson, who recently passed away as we record this. So rest in peace, Mr. Patterson. But McCarron, handling play-by-play, said something pretty ignorant at the beginning of this one, saying that Josh Thompson was high on his teammate in Justin Wilcox, and that with a win here, that he might be up next for a title shot. I mean, this is the guy's Strikeforce debut. He's 5-2 overall. Meanwhile, you got Billy Evangelista, has that many wins in Strikeforce alone. I mean, it was clear that McCarron just didn't have the product or sport knowledge that he needed. And again, we're going to talk about this more at the end. To me, this is one of the big stories of this event, was just the lack of consistency when it came to Strikeforce's commentators early on. So we'll dive into that a little bit more in a little bit. But this is a quick one. Some nice leg kicks from Ishida to start things out. And he seemed to be waiting for Wilcox to shoot in. He didn't have to wait long. As soon as he did, Ishida seized the arm and locked in an armbar, eliciting an immediate tap from Wilcox, who looked like he was hurt to me. I mean, it was pretty nasty armbar.
Are you not going to say anything about Ishida's trunks?
No, I am not planning on saying anything about his little tiny. That was pretty common for a lot of the Japanese fighters, by the way.
Oh, okay. Even Ken Shamrock made a remark. But okay, I'll just say they were a little snug. We'll put it mildly.
That's fair.
Okay. Okay. This guy was great. I mean, I loved watching him fight, even though it was short. He was smooth. He was in and out. He was quick. He was fast. And he just took the silverback out. I mean, this guy was not able to get out of the gate. You know, I think we saw this a little differently. I felt as though Wilcox tapped really early, and I think it's probably because Ishida sunk it in really quick and really fast. I'm used to seeing the guys kind of tough it out for a few seconds with that arm bar, but I felt like he felt it locked. He knew he was done. It hurt, and he tapped. It reminded me of Misha Tate and Ronda Rousey. Do you know if you remember watching Misha Tate's get contorted, and she hung in there for a really long time. That's what
the complete opposite of that.
yeah, and that's what hatred will do. You know, like Tate hated Ronda. She's like, okay, I'm gonna lose my arm if I have to. But I don't know. That's probably not the most intelligent fight thing to say, that he shouldn't have tapped so early when there was no way out. But I did feel that it was a second or two early, and I was disappointed in him. He wasn't going anywhere. There was no escape. So I think you got to do what you have to do so you don't have any long-term injuries. But I did notice that, you know, and I will note too, just, you know, like, you know, it's great to be in shape. Wilcox had that wrestler body, lots of muscle. He looked like he was just chiseled from steel. He looked great. Ishida was made for go. Like, he's sleek, he's fast, and he won the fight, you know. So don't ever judge a fighter by how he looks or the stare. It's all about game plan, preparation.
Dude, that is the next Nike slogan right there, made for go. is that out there, or did you just come up with that? Because I think that's actually really cool.
Well, no, that's Triple H. telling Bill Goldberg, well, not Bill, but telling Goldberg, some fighters are made for show and some fighters are made for go.
When would, like, is that in their like original feud?
Yeah, I mean, maybe I dreamt it. No, I feel like it was the original. Yeah, it was the original feud way back when Hunter was trying to bury everybody on the planet instead of like pumping up Goldberg as being the beast. He was basically trying to make fun of him for looking like a pro wrestler, but not really knowing how to be a pro wrestler. And do you remember that time, speaking of, when Triple H was on the mic and the mic went out and he like banged it against his hand? And then he like, you know, got another one and he said, "These microphones must have been made by Goldberg. They don't work well either." So,
no, I don't remember.
Oh yeah, that must have been. That must have been during Goldberg's original run. But yeah,
yes, yeah, I don't remember that.
I'm doing made for go URL GoDaddy. As soon as it's done, it's mine.
You right should now. Man. That's yeah. I'm like, I just Googled made for show, made for go Triple H, and nothing. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that comes up, but it doesn't seem to be that, but. Man, dude, that's a t-shirt right there, made for go. I love that. That's a great t-shirt. I'd buy it. All right. But both Ishida and Wilcox will be back in Strikeforce the following year on the same card, actually, with Ishida coming back to grant Melendez a rematch. So looking forward to talking about that one. We got three fights left on this card. In a middleweight matchup, Terry Martin defeated Corey DeVella via TKO coming by way of strikes at 208 of the third round. DeVella was 11-2, riding on an 8-fight win streak. 7 months before this event, DeVella, who was nicknamed The One, had beaten Joe Diesel Riggs with a slam that had incapacitated him. This is a big opportunity for DeVella to really cement, because it was a little bit of a fluke win. I mean, Riggs had been in a car accident, had some back issues. So this was a chance for DeVella to really cement himself as a true contender. Martin had some big wins on his resume. He'd beaten Chael Sonnen, George Rivera, and Ivan Salivari. He was coming off a loss to Vitor Belfort at an affliction event. And had actually lost three of his last four bouts, with two of them in the UFC. But I got to say, for a long time UFC and Pride fans, I tweeted this out. Corey DeVella, I actually got side-by-side photos of DeVella and Guy Mezger. I mean, these guys seriously could have been brothers. If not twins, they could have at least been brothers. I mean, same, you know, skin tone, same hair, the nose. Did you see that? I couldn't believe it, how much they looked alike.
Well, I get the same thing all the time with me and Luke Rockhold, so I know what they're talking about. I did look it up, and yeah, they look alike. There's something about the nose that they look kind of similar, definitely.
Yeah. Anyways, very noticeable height advantage for DeVella. He was 6'2", while Martin was 5'8", so definitely a huge reach advantage for DeVella. Good takedowns for Martin early on. And, you know, I really felt like this was something where Martin was really trying to kind of stake his claim with that. But I got to say, man, the commentators were trying to talk up DeVella, and I just was not very impressed with him. I mean, his striking looked pretty pedestrian overall, you know, pretty JV, if you will. And I mean, he did land a couple nice knees, but Shamrock was, you know, giving him some good commentary, like good critique in his commentary on this. But, you know, I just was not impressed with him. But I will say he was the more aggressive fighter. And even when Martin got takedowns, DeVella defended well. And then as the fight went on, you would have thought that DeVella was winning the way that the commentary was saying. I mean, you would have thought he was winning it pretty handily. And I just didn't see it that way at all. Martin wasn't really landing anything solid, but he had DeVella on his back foot a lot. And Shamrock and McCarron they kept talking DeVella up, saying he was winning, but that Martin could change it all with one punch. And then it was interesting. Just as they started saying that, within a few seconds, Martin lands this really powerful, kind of like Mike Tyson, like compact left hook. And it put DeVella on his back, and then he followed up with a very solid right hand. And that was all she wrote. Very, very sudden, violent ending to this. And I got to give hats off to Martin. He showed really good sportsmanship and immediately helped DeVella off of the canvas, which you're really not supposed to do. Cause if he was dealing with some brain issues or something like that there, that wouldn't have been good. But it was a decent fight. And I felt like Martin was the better fighter. I just, like I said, I just don't know how Davila was 11-2 with a couple pretty big wins in, on his record. I just did not see him as the, he seemed pretty green to me. So I don't know what you thought, but I wasn't a huge fan of the one by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, Davila has a style that's a little bit unimpressive, and I think it sort of goes to a lot of the fighters on this show. There was nothing about really anybody, well, Josh a little bit different, but there's nothing about anyone that was explosive. So I think there was a little bit of that. I think Davila may have been seen as the strike force guy, so maybe they're told to pump him up and they wanted him to win. I didn't really like the stoppage. I realized that Davila was not going to probably come back, but I've seen guys take a lot more punches than that, and they let the fight go on. Robbie Lawler versus Ben Askren comes to mind, and I realize there Dana White probably just wanted to see Askren take a few more shots. But, I mean, do you remember that fight? But he just got bloodied and beaten for almost a minute of uncontested shots, and they let it go. So I don't know. I feel like that's one of the things that's inconsistent about MMA is that some guys they let take a lot of punishment and some guys they don't. And obviously he wasn't really going to get escape, but just like the submission here, it just, you know, if you let it go a couple more seconds, I feel like you give the guy every last chance for them to come back. I mean, how many times did he get hit? Twice? What, the big one?
It's just that left hand and then the right hand follow up on the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you could have letting him take a few more, I guess, mm-hmm. but I didn't have any issue with the stoppage. Definitely not like the issues we will have with the stoppage in the main event, but I can see your point, but I don't have an issue with it. All right. In the co-main event, in a 155 pound matchup, Josh Thompson defeated Ash Bowman via TKO coming by way of punches at 114 of the first round. Thompson, of course, had just won the Strikeforce lightweight title from Gilbert Melendez. He was on a 7-fight win streak. Bowman was 9-5 and had won 4 of his last fights. However, none of his opponents were on the level of the punk. I mean, I looked at his record. I don't think I knew any of the names, so nobody was even close to Josh Thompson. So this is going to be a huge step up for the Lion's Den fighter. I do want to mention, you know, having Ken Shamrock on commentary, to me, if I'm Bowman, that messes with my head because I know that my trainer, my guy is on the call and he's watching me. He's right there at cage side. He's on the mic. So he's got to be somewhat, which he actually was very, even handed about it, but that would mess with my head a lot. I wouldn't have liked that at all. But I wanted to mention that, but Gilbert Melendez joined Shamrock and McCarron for the call on this one, and he wouldn't be needed very long. Shamrock asked Gil how he felt seeing Josh with his belt, and he said he just thought about it every day. And Shamrock made a comment, he was like, "I don't know about you, but man, that would tear my guts out." And he said, you know, Gil said he had a lot of respect for Josh and, you know, made a point of saying that, but he was coming to get his belt back because it was really messing with him. As for the fight itself, Bowman and Thompson felt each other out on the feet early on, and Thompson throwing a nice left high kick that Bowman blocked nicely. And the Lion's Den, they called him a prodigy, which I think this put an end to that. Quickly gave the champ a high five in the middle of the fight. It's like, hey, nice one. They jumped on that. Gil and Shamrock both did. And they're saying that's a rookie mistake. It lets your opponent know that they're in your head. I got to say, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, Josh, but to me, like we've seen this before where guys are, I mean, they're in a slugfest. You think of, was the Ultimate Fighter one that started the whole thing, Bonner and Griffin. You know, that was like, you've created something with this other person, and like you're in the third round or the fifth round, and it's obviously, it's been bloody, and you've both landed shots, and there's mutual respect now and all this stuff. I mean, I could see a high five for sure. You know, some guys will hug at the beginning of the final round if it's been a truly memorable fight and all that stuff. You don't do that 30 seconds in after you blocked a left high kick against a guy that you are, you know, definitely over your head with. Like I thought that was pretty stupid of him, and I agreed with Thompson. I don't think it always with Gil and Frank. I don't think it's Gil and Ken, for the Lord, good God. I agree with them. It was really bad look. So did you notice that? Did anything jump out to you on that?
Yeah, I thought that it was just ridiculous. I can't believe that you're going in there to fight the champion of the world. I know it's a non-title fight, but I mean, come on. You got to do better than that. If the guy kicks you in the head and it hurts, then don't sell that, you know? Just let it, just keep fighting, because the second you do that, you let the guy know that you're affected, and that's just, I didn't like it. So I thought it was weak, and it made me think this guy's not going to last very long.
Yeah, it definitely was not one of the smarter things that you can, you know, that you can do, and it definitely didn't bode well for him. But shortly after that, Bowman did land a nice little right hand, but that would be his last positive moment. Josh answered back, landed a shot of his own. He realized that Bowman was stunned a bit, and he poured it on. Actually landed another shot on the ground after Herb Dean had waved off the fight. It was kind of a little bit weird. The two had a discussion afterwards about it, but it was basically Josh thought that didn't realize that Herb had waved off the fight, so there was just a little bit of a confusion there, but definitely a clear-cut, easy win for the Punk.
All right, I'm going to shoot here a little bit, because this fight really pissed me off for a lot of reasons. We talked about how he, you know, gave a little bit of a high five right at the top. And you just wouldn't do that in a real fight. I know we've talked about this before, and, you know, these aren't real fights. There's no biting or eye gouging or anything like that. But you just don't do that. You don't say, hey, nice job kicking my...
Hold on. They're real fights, but we say they're not real street fights.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're saying, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, obviously they're real fights. But what I mean is there are rules.
There are rules to it, yeah.
So I just... That's not something that you would ever do if you're getting your backside pummeled. You'd figure out a way not to get your backside pummeled. So, okay, whatever. He wasn't ready for prime time against Josh Thompson. Second of all, like, what the heck was this? Like, we're just coming off of Josh Thompson, the biggest win of his career. And they put him in there, like, in this match against this guy. I mean, this was just not good follow-up. I mean, it's like he's some mid-carder defending the Intercontinental title, and Roman Reigns is in the main event or something. It's like Josh Thompson is the champion, and he should be promoted in the main event. Now, I realize it's non-title, but it's about your fighters. It's about your stars. So I don't understand that at all. To me, they might as well have not even put Josh Thompson on the card. Maybe they're trying to give him a quick win, but it's a non-title fight, and that always backfires. You think somebody's going to run somebody over, and it's a fight. You might lose. So I thought it was very dumb booking. After that huge card in San Jose, you come back with Josh in the undercard, in the second from the top, against a guy who's clearly out of his league. I don't understand why that was the best thing that they could do with him. It was sort of a waste, and I think they blew a huge opportunity with Thompson as a follow-up to that big show. I'm glad that Melendez did some commentary, but it was not enough, and I just don't understand why Strikeforce would do that. Josh Thompson was not necessary on the show. And put him in the main event if you're going to. And as a side note, nothing about this has to do with Josh. He was great again. His personality was great. Happy, enthusiastic. Even after the fight, he did this weird endorsement, or he was drinking, I don't know what it was, some kind of energy drink or vitamins, and hamming it up for the crowd. Total frat boy. He's always having fun. But I just, like, it was kind of a burial of Josh. I don't understand why he was in that role, even though he had the convincing win.
Yeah, I can't disagree with any of that, especially the part about him not being in the main event. Obviously, that's because Ash Bowman was his opponent, somebody that, you know, wasn't known and all that stuff. But, I mean, he had nothing to gain by doing this. Why make him do a camp and all that stuff if you're not going to put him in there with somebody like Ishida, you know, or you had other lightweights on this card you could have matched him up with? Why do this? So I agree with you. I don't understand it. I don't understand why they would do kind of these non-title fights. They seem to be pretty worthless. And for Josh, he had nothing to gain. You know, he blitzed a guy that he was supposed to beat. You know, it's what, and then what if he had lost, you know, and then what if he'd lost? And again, it's a non-title fight. And then now you got to do that fight for real. And it's just very, very boneheaded, questionable booking. You know, I just don't get it, but I agree with you. But Bowman would be one and done in Strikeforce. We wouldn't have to worry about seeing him again. Be actually the first loss of a career-ending slide. He would lose five more fights, ending his career in 2012 at 9-11. Interestingly, Thompson would be out of action for quite a while after this bout, 14 months, in fact. I just did a little bit of digging to see if I could, you know, find out why he was out for so long, because I did see an interview with him after this where it was saying, or I think it was a recap or something, but basically, you know, obviously not a scratch on him, not injured or anything like that. So I don't know what happened there. So I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll check with Josh and see if I can get an answer. But he did return. He would end up returning just before the end of 2009, and it would be to give Gilbert Melendez a title rematch. So they're very much looking forward to discussing that on a future episode. But we have arrived at the main event, for better or worse, a middleweight matchup between Kazuo Misaki and Joe Riggs. Misaki would defeat Riggs via TKO coming by way of punches at 229 of the second round in a very controversial stoppage. Riggs was coming back to Strikeforce for the first time since getting slammed in his fight with Corey DeVella at the Dome show in Washington State earlier in the year. He'd had back surgery after that and then come back 5 months later to get a win at a regional show. Now he's ready to get back on track inside the hexagon. Misaki was a true grizzled veteran, a multi-time competitor in both Pancrase and Pride. He'd beaten Phil Baroni, Dennis Kang, and Dan Henderson. So a very, very capable fighter with a ton of experience, and we would see that come into play during this fight. Tons of movement early on from Misaki, bouncing off the walls almost. I mean, there really wasn't a whole lot to the first round. Both fighters landed a handful of strikes, but I'd probably give to Misaki 10-9 as he landed more, but very, very extended feeling out process. Both fighters got more aggressive in the second round. Riggs put Misaki down briefly with a straight left, but once the Japanese fighter got back on his feet, he landed a solid straight right, and Diesel actually kind of teetered over onto his back, almost like a tree falling, but he woke right back up as Misaki jumped on him, and Misaki poured it on. Riggs was defending himself. However, he was just covering up, not improving position. None of the, you know, Misaki wasn't hurting him, and referee Josh Rosenthal, though, had seen enough and jumped in and waved it off, and Misaki pulled a pretty dirty move. He dropped a couple more hammer fists after Rosenthal had stopped the fight, but Riggs was more upset with the referee than he was with his opponent. I mean, he was pissed off, to put it mildly, and I didn't have an issue with the stoppage when I first saw it, and this is very controversial. I mean, I'm not saying I'm right, but I didn't see it. I didn't see it as very controversial because Riggs was not intelligently defending himself, in my opinion. However, when I watched on replay, I can see Joe's point because, as Shamrock pointed out, Riggs' arms were up and none of Misaki's strikes were hurting him. So a tough call. I mean, this is where, like, you can fault a ref for a ref saying, well, it was just going to continue to be more of the same, so, you know, that's why I stepped in. And it's like, well, you don't know that, because what if he had turned and turtled and then pulled through Misaki's legs? I mean, you don't know what was going to happen. This, he definitely was not in, he wasn't hurt or in danger at that moment. So I can see it without the benefit of replay being stopped. But then on replay, I was like, no, this is not a good stoppage. So tough call, Josh. I'm sure you have a strong opinion on this. What did you think?
I hated the stoppage. Absolutely hated it. I mean, is it a fight or not? Is it the main event or not? Riggs was defending. His hands were up. You know, there's a lot of outcomes in that position. Your opponent might punch himself out because he's all, you know, jazzed up with adrenaline and he's trying to finish. He might get tired. Maybe you could pull him in, you know, down to your level. You can catch him with a kick. You can roll. I mean, there's things that you can do in that moment. And those are the moments where you see what fighters are made of. You see whether they can survive in that kind of a situation. We know it's possible. We've seen other fighters do that. The other thing of it was the punches were not landing. They were hitting his hands and his arms, and nothing hit his chin. A couple of things, right? It's all about perception. Misaki was fast and he was throwing in flurries. And it didn't help the way Riggs fell. I mean, Riggs fell like he got popped hard. The problem was his fall was much more convincing as impactful than it actually was, because he was actually alert once he hit the ground. I didn't see the referee doing anything. Rosenthal, he's not talking to him. He's not asking him. I don't know if he could see his eyes or not because he was covering up. But I just feel like it was too soon. You have to allow these fighters the opportunity to show what they're made of. Can they come out of this position? Especially since none of these blows actually hit Riggs other than the first one. Very bad stoppage. I mean, if we're going to point fingers at Riggs, that he's got to take some responsibility for. You know, he had just hurt Misaki right before that, and he kind of walked in a little bit gingerly, and he got counter-tagged, and so he needs to learn from that. Like, if you have an opportunity, you got to jump on it. You can't leave it in the hands of the judges. You can't leave it in the hands of bad referees. Referees make mistakes. So, you know, ultimately, Riggs got popped, and he paid the price, but I think that we had to let it go, and it was the main event. Shouldn't have been the main event, but it was the main event. So, whatever. I didn't like this outcome.
Yeah, I can't disagree. You make a lot of good points there, and I can definitely see that. I can see Josh's point in the moment, but you know, yeah, it was. I could see why Riggs would be so upset, and he was. He was quite angry about the finish of the fight. Gave several interviews talking about it. One, he said he was, quote, waiting for Misaki to stop punching, and, quote, not a great game plan, but again, he wasn't being hurt. So I can see why he was upset, but you, at the same time, you can't just cover it up. You have to, even if the strikes aren't hurting you, you have to show that you're trying to improve position or that you're actively defending. You just can't do that. So I could see both sides of it for sure, but in the end, I'd say, yeah, it was a bad stoppage. Riggs would be back soon for Strikeforce, while Misaki would also return, but that would not be until 2012, so we won't be mentioning him for a while. So that's it. So let's wrap things up. No fighters pop for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after this show. Again, I thought Kem Shamrock did a good job on color commentary. Lon McCarron was out of his element, but he could have been worse. They were decent, but is that what you're looking for if you're trying to make yourself out to be a big time MMA promotion? I mean, Strikeforce should have had a consistent commentary team from the outset. Even if you try, I mean, we're 2 years in, and we've got a new commentary team for this event. So it just, I think that really, really hurt the quality of the. You know, what was being portrayed on broadcast. I think it's a bad look. And I wish that they had somebody like, whoever. I mean, like, even if it was Brian Weber and Frank Shamrock, like, at least have a consistent team. You know, I mean, if Mara's not available at this point, if he's busy with Pride, or, I mean, get Stephen Quadros, who would do some commentary later. But there, you know, it just didn't seem like there was any consistency there. And I think it hurt them overall.
The commentary team really is what makes the viewer comfortable. You get into these rituals and these routines, and it becomes part of your family to some degree. I mean, when you go to watch Sunday Night Football, you know you're going to get Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth. They're familiar. You can expect consistency. In the UFC, it was Rogan and Goldberg for so long, and that was, like, when you heard it, you're like, oh, there's UFC on. That was far more familiar than maybe whoever was in the cage fighting. And Strikeforce changed way too much. We never really got settled in on a team at this stage, because it was always experimental. It was always like, oh, let's put Ken Shamrock in there. He's got some fighters on this card. Oh, let's get this person. Oh, let's pull in this celebrity from this other genre, and we'll see if maybe we can appeal to young people. It wasn't actually ever televised. So it's like, yeah, it did not make a lot of sense. And as good as Scott Coker was, some of these little details, and I don't even know if he's entirely was in charge of all of this, but some of these little presentation details were just a little off at this stage.
Yeah, I agree. Just further illustrating my point, you know, I think it hurt him. So, but total disclosed fighter payroll was $159,000. Kazuo Misaki only made $1,400 for his main event win, while Joe Riggs made $20,000. Josh Thompson made $40,000, including a $21,000 win bonus. Ash Bowman got $2,000. Trevor Prangley got $40,000 as well, while Anthony Ruiz got $6,000. So overall, despite some watered-down matchmaking, I thought it was an entertaining event for the most part, but really more of a junior, like, really, you know, somewhere in between what should be a major tentpole event and, like, a challengers event. It was definitely not a huge event, but, you know, kind of a bummer to have a questionable stoppage in the main event, which hurts things too, but there were some good finishes. What did you think overall, Josh?
Should have been called, instead of Strike Force at the Mansion, it should have been called Strike Force in Your House, because that's the kind of show that it felt like.
That's a good way of putting it.
I was not thrilled with the show. At times it was a little boring, and mostly it just felt unfamiliar, felt a little bit awkward. You know, on the bright side, it had less of that Playboy Mansion feel that the first Playboy Mansion show had. I think it was darker for some reason. We didn't see as many of the empty seats and as much of the scenery and the background as we did with the first show. We did see Hugh Hefner. We did see him with his entourage. But it did feel more like just a fight card. At least that was my experience. And I thought Kenny Shamrock did a good job. I think that we needed a play-by-play person who was a master of MMA. And then you could maybe experiment a little bit with the color commentator or a third person in the booth. We still don't have that yet. The fights were fine. There was not a tremendous moment, a super shocking KO. You know, we did have a good submission that was kind of cool. But overall, I just felt like I didn't recognize a lot of the characters. And that's one of the things that was difficult about Strikeforce at the beginning. A lot of moving parts, a lot of people in and out from the actual fighters to the commentary team, to the presentation. It was just sort of off. As somebody who loves MMA, obviously the fights are what matters, and the show was just fine. It was not tremendous by any means, but Strikeforce would get better. I just think the sad part is we still, at this point in time, in September 2008, and they've been around for a couple of years, we have these super highs and these super lows, and we just never quite know yet what to expect with a Strikeforce show.
Yeah, very well put. I agree with all of that. I'm glad we're moving on from this and we don't have to deal with Playboy shows anymore, because they weren't the most fun to cover. But, you know, some nuggets that came out of this. We are working on some of our upcoming episodes. Like I mentioned earlier, kind of had breaking news that we're going to be talking with Trevor Prangley, and that's going to be the fighter interview, so to speak, for this show. So I'm looking forward to delving into that. After that, we're covering Strikeforce Payback, which featured a main event of Dwayne Bang Ludwig versus Sammy Morgan. Also on that card was the legendary Frank Trigg. We're supposed to talk with Frank. I don't know if it's going to be in time for that show, so it may end up being a bonus episode. So we may end up talking to Bang Ludwig for that fight, for that event, but I'm looking forward to covering that event itself and then talking to those fighters as well. We've also got an interview with former Strikeforce light heavyweight champion Hinato Babalu Sobral that should be coming up pretty soon. So some good stuff that's going to be happening. Again, you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. We would love to hear your feedback. You can find us on Twitter and on Instagram @thehexagonpod. So make sure you follow us there. Always got some good interaction with various fighters and different things like that. We always put out fresh content, so please check us out there. And then finally, please remember to rate and review the show, especially on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate every single review that we get, every single rating that we get. We'd love to hear more from you, more feedback, but please help us out with that. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. We hope that you will stay safe and you will stay healthy. We will see you soon.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.